get started. I'm glad you're here. The plan this afternoon, someone asked me earlier, and I hadn't mentioned it to the large group, to go till, you know, as late as 3:30. If we're done before that, that's fine, but we won't go beyond that. Our theme is grief and loss, and Jerry has done some very difficult work in that area, and there's a book that he's written about that. How many people have read this book? About a third of you. I wanted to just read part of one of the paragraphs in the preface that I just thought was just very, very true and very helpful to remember. And then I'll pray and invite Jerry to come forward and lead this time. He says, sooner or later, all people suffer loss, in little doses or big ones, suddenly or over time, privately or in a public settings. Loss is as much a part of normal life as birth, for as surely as we are born into this world, we suffer loss before we leave it. For me, just reading that was helpful to realize we can't avoid loss. It will happen. Unless we want to die really early ourselves, we will experience loss in life. And so it's something we have to go through, which we never like. But there are ways, and we are not alone. So let's pray. God, we thank you for this time. You know the stories of each person in this room and why they have taken up part of their Saturday afternoon to be here. And we thank you that we have this time together. And we thank you for Jerry and his willingness to share what he's learned with us. And we just pray that your Spirit would meet each one where we need to be met, that you would help us to see you, see ourselves, see this world, see our losses, whether they're right in front of us or to come, in the light of the good news of who you are. In Jesus' name, amen.
Okay, there we go. Great. Okay, thanks for staying around for this afternoon. I think it's a little too loud, maybe. No, it's okay. Yeah. this is going to be a little more informal. I want you to be able to talk some too, so it's not just a lecture on loss. But I want to begin with just a couple of introductory comments. The first is that it's a weird thing to write a book about this, because it gives the impression you're an expert, and none of us are experts. I'm not an expert. It's a book of really theological reflection about my loss and what that means about loss in general. But it's a dangerous thing to write a book on loss, and it's a tricky thing to write a book about loss. I thought about this a long time, and I had a couple of good friends consult me as I went along. If it's too much about you, it keeps everybody out. If it's too much about loss from a theological or psychological perspective, then you start to treat it clinically as if you're an expert. So it's a very small window. I'm not sure I hit it, but I've read a lot of books that have not hit it. They've been really poorly done. Either they're too self-indulgent, or they have too many answers. And it's just a very difficult thing to write a book about something as personal and as painful as a loss. So, again, I'm not claiming success here. I'm just wanting to say I'm aware of that problem and the dangers involved when you're writing about your own personal experience, especially of loss. Excuse me. The second thing I want to say is that my loss is one loss and it's my own. And I do not think it's better or worse or anything else from everybody else's. We all have our stories to share. And over the years, because I've gotten so many letters, thousands of letters from this one book alone, I've heard a lot of stories. And I'll tell you, the different experiences of loss are almost as many as the people themselves. It's just remarkable. I've gotten stories about the drip, drip, drip of loss. Somebody who loses a loved one to Alzheimer's until they can't recognize them anymore. I've gotten letters about that. It's really very difficult, hard loss, because you feel like you've lost a person who's still alive, still with you. Lots of stories about the losses that have come from cancer. And there's a recovery and then a drop and then another recovery. And it can be this long roller coaster kind of experience it becomes profoundly erosive to a person who has to deal not just with the loss, but all the medical problems associated, all the caretaking they have to do, all the emotional work they have to do. I've gotten three stories where either a parent or a child ran over one of the children and that led to death, including, who's the famous musician that lost a child? Stephen Curtis Chapman. And he actually called me and we talked several times on the phone. And I think it was his son who by accident backed over, what was it, a 1.5-year-old? Oh, so adoptive daughter from China. Sorry, I've forgotten some of the facts. I have no categories for that. And then to watch that happen. Another one that really sticks to me because it was local in Spokane was a young man I'm very close to. His wife went to Whitworth, and she was in a small group I was leading when our family went through our own tragedy. And he was and still is the director of a Christian camp north of Spokane, and he was there in June with his wife, and I think they had three boys then, but the 7-year-old was out tubing with a teenager on, and another boat was distracted and ran right over that tube, and they watched as their 7-year-old was killed. And I'll tell you, that was a lot of hard work for that couple. Now they're doing fine. But it was enormously hard work. And then, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, his brother committed suicide. And his brother was living with them. So you get the idea. I mean, that's gruesome. It's painful. It's immediate that you've got the slow drip, drip, drip. Some losses make a person heroic. That happened to me to some degree. Other losses are shameful. Loss of a marriage, for example. Or one man said to me, this is kind of wonderfully audacious in a way, but he took me aside once and he said, I want you to know I've resented you for 3 years. And I said, why? And he said, your loss made you a hero. And my loss is different. My wife left me for a woman and I'm filled with nothing but shame. I'm glad he said that to me. That's a legitimate feeling to express. And he said, but we both felt pain. But my pain is different from yours. And I can't wear it as a badge, so to speak, you know. So I just want to acknowledge to you, honestly, that I look at my experience as my own. It's not any better or worse. It's just different. All losses, as I say in my book, actually, are bad, just bad in different ways. And part of, one of the meaningful parts of loss is the friendships, the community that you develop with other people who've gone through the same thing or similar experiences. And you can find life there. You share life with people and you weep together. And you tell your stories. And I have had the utter privilege of being a recipient of so many stories from around the whole world. that have been lovely. Another one comes to mind. These are all just literally flashing across my brain right now. I got a letter, oh gosh, this is probably 7 years ago or something, from a mother who lives in New Zealand. Her 16-year-old daughter was enrolled in a private academy, Christian academy, and they were taking a month-long wilderness program with other seniors. She must have been older than that then, seniors in the school, called the Sir Edmund Hillary Outdoor Academy. You know, he was the first one to successfully climb Mount Everest, at least survive afterwards. And they were climbing in a canyon in New Zealand, climbing up the walls of the canyon. And little did they know, about 25 miles upstream, there had been a gigantic storm. And it dumped huge amounts of water into the river, and it came down that canyon like a wave. And she was a little higher than everybody else and saw 7 students and a teacher all swept to their death. And she was the only survivor. Well, you can imagine her mother. What would it be like to be a parent of that child? And just to feel so sick because of the survivor guilt, and to witness that, 17-year-olds are simply not built for that kind of tragedy. And so she asked me to write a letter to each of the families, which I did, and I heard from most of them. Ironically, I wrote a letter to this same woman, one of the mothers of one of the kids who died, and she just lost her husband about 6 months ago, too. So I'm not trying to dazzle you with these stories just to say, oh my goodness, we're part of a pretty big family, aren't we, of people who have really had their faith put to the test. So, and I get the privilege of at least hearing a few of those stories. And you know, the other thing I'm going to say to you is it's never grown old. I don't know why, but I don't know. I was rewired. My nerve system was rewired after I lost my wife and mother, daughter, and I've never been the same. Tears are really easy for me now. I never used to cry. My children are entertained by how quickly I can cry. That's just kind of how I've evolved as a human person before God now. So these stories never grow old to me. Yeah. So I would like you to make some noise so you're not just sitting here dumb. So it would be wonderful if you could, just for a few minutes, grab somebody you don't know and just talk about, if not your own experience of loss, if it's too difficult, to talk about some of the losses you've witnessed over the years with family and friends or church members. The kinds of things that you've seen, the variety of experiences that all push us to the edge. As you know, if you've read the book, I make a distinction between normal losses and what I call irreversible losses. It's the difference between a broken leg and an amputation. There are some kinds of losses that are hard, but over time, you can kind of get back to where you were before. Say you're an athlete and you get injured your sophomore year and lose a season, but you can get back in the gym and get rehab and go to a physical therapist and you come back your junior year and you're better than you were before. That is a loss. It's a legitimate loss. And you can understand the feelings of pain and sorrow and so on when you're a 16-year-old and you lose a season of sports. Fair. Very different when you lose a limb and will never play the sport again. You see the difference? I call these irreversible, the kinds of things where they draw a line and you can't get back behind it again, no matter how long you wait. It changes the conditions or circumstances of your life so that there's no returning to what you had before under any terms. So you can remarry, but it's obviously not to the same person. You can't get behind it. You can't get behind the loss of a child, or the loss of a marriage, or whatever it happens to be. There are some kinds of losses that draw a permanent line in the sand that make impossible some kind of return. And that's what I want to talk about more. Those, what I call those irreversible losses. So if we could have some noise, that would be great. Just grab somebody and talk a little bit about however personal you want it to be, your own experiences of loss, and try to talk to somebody maybe you don't know, because I think you're probably sitting with people you do. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, I can just leave and let you guys keep talking. It's going to be much better than hearing me anyway. Honestly, that's some of the best therapy there is just literally sharing a story with another person and receiving that, you know. And I see lots of tears here. I appreciate it, too. I was going to say one other thing in the introductory comments I forgot. The one thing I did not address in A Grace Disguised was suicide. And the reason why is because that is so unbelievably complex that I wouldn't even know where to begin. So I never mention it. And I've had some people say that was a big disappointment to them. But you can hardly mention that one in passing because it's got some unique features to it that make it especially difficult. And I've known, obviously heard from many people who've dealt with suicide one way or another, including a few really high-profile people, and it's just got its own kind of life, its own set of challenges. The comments I receive more than anything is, number one, tell me what to think about this. In other words, if I figure out how to think about it the right way, then I won't have to feel it. And thinking is not a shortcut. Thinking will not spare you from feeling pain. It may help you to frame the pain differently and provide more hope. It can do that. But it will not spare you from anything. Christian theology carries an unnecessary burden when it seems to promise that somehow it's going to spare us from these kinds of things. We're asking Christian theology to do something that it can't do. And sometimes I think we do that. We assign theology a responsibility that it cannot fulfill. And we tell it to bear a burden it can't bear. Pain is pain, loss is loss, and there's nothing that's going to spare us from the hard and long journey of going through it. A second one is, when am I going to start feeling better again? Well, that's a tricky question. And the reason why is because it depends on what you mean by feel better. And usually what that means is, when am I going to start feeling better as I used to define the better? In which case, I can answer, never. That will never happen. Now, you're going to feel, I don't know what word to use there. It's not going to be better. It's going to be worse. You're going to feel different. And for the most part, that might be a good experience. In some ways, it's going to be a liberating experience. But better, as you previously defined it, or as anyone previously defines it, as I previously defined it, is simply not going to happen. So, you know, in my case, I lost my wife when I was 41 years old. I was widowed for almost 20 years. And then I fell in love and I married again. And I love my second wife. But I didn't stop loving my first. I never will. Fortunately, I married somebody who understands that and honors me for it. In fact, she says, it actually works to my advantage. If you can be half as fiercely loyal to me as you were to your first wife, I'm going to be a really happy woman. So when am I going to start feeling better again is a really legitimate and normal question to ask, but I can't answer that question in a way that's going to be satisfying, because you won't. The third one is, when am I going to get over this? When am I going to move beyond it? And my response then, and of course, I don't answer anybody as if I'm an expert. I just don't do that. But in a conversation I may have to with a person, it will be something like, no, you. The best way is not to get over it, it's to grow into it. You learn to wear it. It's like clothes that you gradually grow into. You don't get around, you grow into, and you begin to carry it differently. And the reason why I say that is because I actually think that's a Christian virtue. Not only to carry our own sorrows, but to carry other people's too. Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn. He did not say, blessed are those who once mourned. Or blessed are those who got over their mourning and now feel better. No, it's blessed are those, present tense, who are mourning. They're the ones who are going to be comforted. Now, there are lots of ways of mourning. The most obvious is mourning over our own losses. It's the things that we sorrow over, a spouse or a child or health or whatever it happens to be, a marriage. But isn't it a sign of Christian virtue when we begin to mature and we not only learn to carry our own sorrows, but we learn to carry the sorrows of other people too? And one of the primary ways we learn how to do that is how we carry our own. There are some people who experience a loss in such a way and they collapse in on themselves. And life is only about their own loss. But a sign of growth and health is not that you get over it, but that you grow into it in such a way that you carry it differently and you discover yourself with the capacity to carry other people's losses too. Now, you know what? The church did that for me. I used to go to church, to worship, I should say. We're the church. I used to go to worship. And for probably 2 years, I never sang a hymn because every time I tried, I started to cry. I couldn't pray. I didn't know what to say. It wasn't like I didn't believe in prayer. I was mute. I did not know what to say. And somewhere along the line, I discovered that the church was singing for me, and I just let it sing. The church prayed for me. Not just for me directly, but just for me. The church believed for me. And I kind of gave myself a break from believing and singing and praying, thinking, well, the church can do this for me for a while. And now guess what? I do it for a whole lot of other people. And many of you do too. That's kind of our job description. I remember a conversation I had with a woman quite a few years ago, probably 8 years ago now. And she was talking about a loss and then was expressing utter torment that she just didn't believe anymore. Now, it's not like she disbelieved. She just didn't have enough energy to believe. There was just nothing left inside her. And I looked at her and I said, you know what? Why don't you let me believe for you for a while? And then when you're ready, you can kind of step back into belief again and you'll end up doing that for somebody else. And she was so profoundly relieved that that was not a wrong thing to do. That's what we do for each other. I mean, it's like what raising children. I've had a lot of people help me raise my children and borne that burden. And I've done that for them in due time. So how can I get over this? How can I get beyond this? You don't, you shouldn't, but you can grow into it and absorb it and carry it differently. Some ideas I found helpful along the way. One is to beware of some traps we can fall into. I'm going to express just a little bit, and then we'll do some questions, and then I'll bring some concluding comments. But I say watch for some traps. Here's one. I already mentioned it. Getting over instead of growing into. That's a trap. Expecting that you're going to somehow graduate from it. You won't graduate from this. None of us do. None of us should. And to me, it's a tragedy if we do. We need to carry these things with us. I'll come back to talk about capacity in just a minute. Another trap is to look for replacement. No replacement, there can be additions. So my second marriage is not a replacement for my first. My first marriage stands on its own. My gosh, she was the mother of my four children. She's still very much present in our family's life. She's actually present in my second wife's life in a good way. It's all part of our story. So a replacement, I think, is a bad option. Additions are good things. Going to concerts, having new experiences, new relationships, new families, taking on new jobs, moving into a new house, all kinds of things that can add enrichment to our life, but none of that can serve as a replacement. Think new chapters don't nullify older ones, even the hard ones. They add to it. Another one is to start slipping into the mentality that suffering began with me. It didn't. It's a universal experience. It's been going on since Adam and Eve. The reason why that's a danger is because we can collapse into self-pity and start to think that I'm the first one who's ever suffered on the planet. No, I'm not, and no, you aren't. We've stepped into a universal experience, and there are literally billions of people who have gone before us who have experienced the same thing. The fact is, the world has fallen and the world is groaning. And suffering can help us become attuned to the groaning of the world. I remember after 9/11, the president of the faculty and the president of the university asked me to speak to our faculty about this. And the first thing I said is that those 3,000 people who died, every one of them has their own story. It wasn't just 3,000 things. It was 3,000 actual people, each that has left behind a trail of tears and suffering. The suffering did not begin with them either, or with me, or with you. The world has fallen. It's groaning all the time. And suffering, our own, can help us become attuned to that suffering world. Another trap to fall into is not attending to what I call our primary emotions. God has hardwired us with emotion. Now, we have different capacities and different degrees. Some are more inclined towards, say, anger. Other people are more inclined toward a lot of tears. And there are so many different ways we express that. But all of us are, by creation, emotional creatures. Emotion is not something to avoid. It's something to embrace. And sometimes you feel like you're going crazy because it just keeps coming at you. Week after week, month after month, even year after year, you think, my gosh, it's been 10 years and I still cry a lot. As if something is wrong with you. I say, bless you. I'm glad you're crying. Tears are a gift. They're a sign of health. The sign of unhealth I'll mention in just a minute, but our emotion is a gift that God has given to us. We have an entire book of the Bible that is devoted to human emotion. One whole book, the longest book of the Bible. It's the book of Psalms. And they turn those emotions into a prayer. And those are pretty unseemly prayers sometimes. The Psalms are unvarnished. I mean, you have somebody shaking his fist at God, being angry at God, saying, look, your fan club is pretty small as it is, and you're reducing it by the day. What are you, stupid? They express bewilderment and anger and confusion and all kinds of emotions. And they turn these into a prayer. I like to say to people, God is an adult. He can handle it. I remember when my youngest, John, was about 2, 3, 4. He was always my most expressive child. And I mean, I was either the greatest father in the world or the worst father in the world, and not much in between. So every once in a while he would say, "I hate you, I hate you, I hate you." Now, I could have said, "Well, I guess I hate you too." I mean, that would have been terrible. Instead, it was, "I know, John. I know. Maybe tomorrow you won't." I would receive the emotion. Now, I'm a parent and not a very good one. Imagine how God responds. He can absorb our emotion. We need to direct it toward Him and do it in an unvarnished way. He is not put off by that, and the Psalms are a good example of that. My God, why have you forsaken me? When Jesus died, he had a psalm on his lips. And it was one of those unvarnished psalms. The reason why that's important is because of the distinction I make between primary and secondary emotions. Primary emotions are the things that immediately well up in some kind of experience of loss. They're the things that come to the surface immediately. The Desert Fathers called them the insensitive emotions. In other words, the things that are in where we're incensed, where there's an immediate reaction to something, where somebody cuts you off in traffic and you want to flip them off right away. That's an insensitive emotion. That's immediate. All right? Those are the emotions that we need to attend to and express to God in prayer or to friends or both, preferably. The reason why is because the real emotions we face that are the more dangerous are what I call the secondary emotions. That would be bitterness. Anger is different from bitterness. If bitterness is an explosion like a geyser, bitterness is like poison that just simmers in the pot over a long period of time. So I would call bitterness a secondary emotion. It's got more will in it. It's something we choose over time. Self-pity is one of those. You begin to think you're a special case, worse than everybody else. Or revenge. You begin to plot on your bed. You become utterly preoccupied with the wrong that was done to you. I think you get the idea. These are the secondary emotions that really can become destructive to the soul. And ironically, if we don't attend to the primary emotions we have, it's more likely, not inevitable, but more likely that we're going to be dealing with those secondary ones, more involved with the will that can really lead to a permanent destruction of the soul. By the way, the same thing works on the other side. There are what I call primary emotions that are positive, like happiness. You know, you're 16 years old and you were hoping so-and-so would invite you to the prom and they finally call. And you just sort of bounce into the room to tell mom and dad and you're all happy and ebullient and, oh my gosh, isn't this wonderful? That would be a primary emotion. It's associated with circumstances. All of a sudden, life has become favorable to you, see? Okay, so that would be an example of a primary emotion on the more positive side of things. Secondary emotions on the more positive side of things are the things that run deeper, that are less circumstantial, like joy or peace or especially love. Those, again, are subject to the human will. They're cultivated by discipline. They're not as related to circumstance. So here's a line from Psalm 4 that I love so much. It's a wonderful psalm, but it goes, at one point it says, "Thou hast put more joy in my heart than they," his fellow countrymen, "that they have when their grain and wine abound." Now listen to it again. "Thou hast put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound." In other words, he's saying, even when their crops are in and they've got the best wine that they've had in 10 years, see how circumstantial it is? You know, they cut a deal, they won a tournament, they did something, so immediately they're happy. And he says, my joy runs deeper because it's not subject to grain and wine. It's subject to deeper things. And this, by the way, is what can happen over time in an experience of loss, in being stripped of circumstances that make us happy, that are immediate and fragile and subject to loss. We begin to discover our capacity for deeper emotions that are less subject to circumstances and more subject to a relationship with God. You see the difference between the two? The last one, I think I'm going to wait on that and circle back to it. Okay, questions or comments so far? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question was, how do you approach a loss that seems to have multiple dimensions to it? It's not just a thing. It sets in motion a kind of avalanche of losses, maybe rejection or loss of friendship or a community of people who can support you. Well, I've heard a lot of stories about this where, say, something happens in a church, maybe prominent leaders, and there's a divorce, and then people start choosing sides, and then it just begins to lead to one loss after another, like compounding interest. Okay. Well, these are, I would call these the losses that are more complicated as opposed to the ones that are pretty clear and clean. Mine was awful but clear and clean. I had three family members one day, and they were gone the next day. But, you know, I had a great relationship with my mom. I loved my little girl, Dinah Jane. That morning she had sat on my lap, and I had prayed with her and read stories to her. And I was married to a wonderful woman who loved me. I mean, it's pretty simple. It was pretty awful and pretty simple, but pretty simple all the same. And that doesn't happen to all people. Sometimes something can happen and it sets off a chain reaction that may lead to a job loss, loss of friendship, loss of community. It can become very entangled and, for that matter, all the worse. No comment, but I've seen it happen a lot. I think the work you have to do is probably more complicated. I think finding a therapist might be the best thing to do to kind of sort things out. Finding a small group of friends who can really support you through it and address the various dimensions of the multiple losses. And frankly, I'm going to say this not to you, but to all of us here. Loss sometimes forces us to look hard at ourselves. And that can be the hardest work to do of all. So you lose a spouse, and it just seems like you lost the spouse. But after a year or so, you begin to think, wait a minute, maybe there's more going on here than meets the eye. And you start to look at yourself and the kind of spouse you were to that person. And you discover, not very good in some ways. So it forces you to do the kind of work inside yourself that really is a sign of health for all of us. To turn and look at ourselves in the mirror and ask, well, maybe some of those friends walked away from me and it was partly their issue, but partly mine too. That's hard work, but it's the hard work I think we should do when we're dealing with loss. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it was your fault. A lot of things aren't a matter of fault. They just are, but we can still learn from them. Yeah. Other questions or comments thus far? Mm-hmm. I think he wants to give you a mic here.
I want the mic.
Hello.
Can you address how fear sort of, you know, maybe derails you a little bit and prevents you from, you know, being the best you can be or showing up or helping others?
Sure. Well, it's a great question because a lot of people are absolutely dominated by fear. So a mother loses a child and refuses to let her other three children out of her sight ever again, right? Because she's so terrified, what if it happens again? You see what I mean? There can be a lot of ways of this happening. You lose, let's say, a business, and you're always afraid to start another one. I mean, it can go on and on, those examples of losses that make us gun-shy, losses that terrify us and remind us that this could happen again. And my response is that it could happen again. But fear isn't an answer to that. It's not going to protect you. If anything, it may exacerbate the problem. Somewhere, you got to get back on that horse and ride it again and recognize that the other alternative is to live in fear and still face another possible loss. And that, in my mind, is not very helpful. So I think you have to turn and face the fear square on and call it fear and realize that it's tying you in knots and debilitating you, and then blow a whistle on it and say, it's there, I feel it, it's not going to go away anytime soon, but I'm not going to let it control my life, and start making decisions to step out into the larger world and do stuff, even though that is not going to spare you. I mean, I may lose, well, I will lose my second spouse or she will lose me. Period. The decisions we make that are of greatest value are the decisions that also promise the greatest loss. That's just a fact of life. You choose to love, you'll choose to lose. Try having kids. Hardest thing in the world to do. And there's no way you can avoid loss. Marriage is the same way. Investment in people. So I think you just got to turn and face the fear square on and not expect it to go away. But make decisions while it's still there. A lot of us think that the way to overcome emotion is to wait for it to subside, instead of just turn and take it square on. In my book, probably the image that people have mentioned more than any other is the dream I had where I was chasing after the sun that was setting with this feeling of utter desperation because I wanted to stay in the light. I was chasing it west toward the horizon. And I realized that the sun was beating me to the horizon and I couldn't keep up with it. And finally, I stopped, exhausted, and saw the sun set. And then I turned to the east and saw the darkness sweep over me. And in that existential moment, I thought I was going to be in darkness for the rest of my life. It was a feeling of utter terror. And I woke up in darkness. And I thought this was it. This was my life sentence. Living in darkness. I could not stay in that sun. As I say in the book, in this case, I called my sister the next day and told her. And then two things happened. She said to me, you know what? I think this is cue, Jerry. You looked east and there was nothing but darkness. But as we well know, the quickest way to the sun is not to keep running west. It's to turn east and plunge right into the darkness. All the sooner you come to the sunrise. And then a cousin of mine sent a poem by John Donne, 17th century metaphysical poet and an Anglican preacher. And in his poem, he makes a distinction between east and west on a map and east and west on a globe. On a map, a flat map, east and west are infinitely removed from each other. The farther you go one direction, the farther you are from the other, right? But on a globe, what happens? They meet. Right? You see the difference? And those two things gave me the cue I needed. I felt utter terror living in the darkness. But I realized if I was willing to stay in that darkness, I'd sooner come to the sunrise. And so I chose to stay in it. Now I'm going to add, and this is really strange for me to say, but I'm going to add, I had one huge advantage. And maybe many of you do too. I have never suffered from a lot of mental illness. There's a difference there. People who have a strong inclination, say, of being bipolar, or a strong inclination toward depression, it gets complicated with significant losses. That was not my battle. I've always been a reasonably healthy person, or as we like to say in our family, a sturdy ship. Having said that, losing three family members in an accident is a really bad day. So there were some advantages and disadvantages when it came to that. But that cue changed my life. I realized I'm going to have to get used to being in the darkness for a while. And if I keep trying to chase after a sun that's faster than I am, I'm just going to prolong it. When you're traveling in a jet going west, you can be in night for many hours. If you're traveling in a jet going east, when the sun goes down, it comes up a lot faster. See what I mean? So sometimes we face these fears, these terrors, and if we're reasonably healthy people, it's best just to go right at them and not wait for them to kind of disappear. Mm-hmm. I want to let other people ask some questions. Any other questions? Comments? Mm-hmm. Irrationality? No, because it's totally rational to me.
The irrationality of grief.
Yeah.
I think of myself as a rational person, scientifically educated. When my wife died, it was expected, long-term diabetes sort of thing. Disappointing, very much so. I found it very difficult to forgive her for dying.
Seems pretty normal to me. I just
7.5 months. Then I forgave her. Then mm-hmm. everything was okay. But long time.
Seems healthy to me. I don't know what's irrational about that. How long were you married?
52 years from one day.
Okay. There you go. I mean, from a rational point of view, it would be the longer you stay married, the easier it should be because you have all those wonderful years to remember. That's just all bullshit. That's 52 years of life that you shared with the person and she's gone. I'd feel bad for a really long time. Well, that's the way you worked it out. Somebody else, it's going to be, I can't forgive me. Those are just all the emotions because you're trying to make rational sense out of something that's not rational. It's loss. We weren't built for this. We have eternity in our hearts. When we lose people, there's something that is so deeply violated in us because we carry the stamp of the nature of God on us. We were made for God. We were made for eternity. We were made for love. And when all that gets destroyed, it's just so disorganizing. It's so disorienting. Isn't that right? And that was your way of working it out. Why did she leave me? Why did she abandon me? I wanted to die first. I'm glad you worked it out in only 7.5 months. That could be a record. There's nothing irrational about that. It's your way of trying to make sense of it. 52 years is a long time to share life. Yeah. I'm no expert, folks. Most of the time, I have no idea what I'm doing. In anything. One or two other questions? Some other people? Mm-hmm.
this is a not nearly the grief of losing someone, although I have. It's a grief of aging.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
grief of aging. Mm-hmm. Body not doing what you've done all your mm-hmm. life. And I'm very blessed. I really am. And I'm thankful for mm-hmm. what I still can do. But still, that's a form of grief that
it absolutely is
insidious in
yeah.
your whole day. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, just something.
Oh, no, that's so wise and healthy to say, especially in our culture, because we're very youth-oriented in American culture, and that makes elderly people feel very marginal. Yeah, honey, Dad, we'd like to see you, but, you know, Ed's got his soccer match, and we'll try to get there in the next week. That's our culture. Technology favors the youth. All of our models are young and skinny and beautiful. And when you get older, you get a little fatter, and your hair goes away, and you've got creases on your face, and you begin to have health problems, and you feel alone. And you feel left behind. You feel pushed aside. It's really hard to grow old in any culture, especially our culture. I just put my mother-in-law on the plane 2 days ago. Pat and I did. She came out. She had no business coming out. She has so many medical problems. She's so fragile. She gets confused and so on. She's on this airplane. But she just had her first great-grandson born. And this was going to be it. This is her one shot. She wanted to come out here and see him. So she got a lot of time with that little grandson. But she has so many pains and aches and everything in her. And we got her on the plane. She went to the O'Hare Airport to get back to Albany. She's on her wheelchair. Somebody's keeping an eye on her from the airline. She says she has to go to the bathroom. She goes to the bathroom and she falls asleep and misses the plane on the toilet. She doesn't know where she is. I mean, you get the idea. And I remember saying to her, she was visiting, I looked at her and I said, Mary Ellen, it's really hard to grow old, isn't it? And she started to cry. That is a grief. Partly because you remember what you once were. Your memory was sharper. You had people answering to you in your business or whatever it happens to be. Students that are sitting at your feet learning. In my case, you know. There's something kind of airy and exciting about living in that world. And now, pretty much everybody ignores you. Not really, but you get the point. That's all a loss. Thank you. It's one of those quiet ones. It's like the woman who's miscarried for the third time. She has no physical marks of being suffering loss, and only a handful of people knows because she just didn't want to go around telling everybody I suffered my third miscarriage. It's quiet. It's private. It's awful.
I lost my sister 3 years ago this Christmas. She died 2 days before Christmas. And that was really rough because I never got to see her again. I talked to her 2 weeks before she died, but Christmas wasn't Christmas without her and my sister. And I married this wonderful fellow that lost his wife 52 years ago. I married him a year ago, a week from tomorrow. So it was a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, sure.
And he made my mom giggle. He made my mom laugh. My mom cry. But my mom died the year after I met him, February 10th this year. And it's been a blessing to me. I've never met and had such a wonderful man in my life.
Well, it's good news. See how it's all mixed together? Yeah, which leads to a few concluding comments. The first thing is that loss can enable us to develop or to discover and develop our own human capacity. So these fingertips right here, they're wired with nerve endings that are very sharp, and they have tremendous capacity. Talk to a violinist sometime about what those nerve endings can do. They can produce dozens of different sounds simply by how hard they push down on the string, or how they do it, or how they move their fingers. Now, you and I have the same capacity in our nerve endings as that violinist does. But that violinist, over years of practice, has developed that capacity. Bakers can sense with their fingertips a 1% variation in the moisture content of dough. I couldn't discern a 50% difference. See what I mean? Nerve endings can scream at you when you get something jammed underneath a fingernail. They can also communicate to you the utter beautiful pleasure of warm hands in cold water, or running fingers over a lover's hair, or holding and feeling the skin of a newborn baby. Right? It's all there. It has capacity. The capacity has to be developed and trained. And loss is one of those ways, or one of those occasions when that can occur. I'll tell you, I've met people whose capacity for love is extraordinary. And when you dig deep, one of the things you discover, in many, not all, but many cases, was the loss that they suffered.
Mm-hmm. Can you address the idea that someone's lack of faith has caused a loss?
I need more than that. What do you mean by lack of faith?
Because I wasn't faithful enough.
All right, well, I'm gonna comment in two ways to that. The first one is that all of us want to make rational sense of losses. And one of the easiest ways to make rational sense of something is simply to take the blame for it yourself. That gives you a chance to order the world, even though you're miserable in the process. At least you make sense out of reality that way. I can't tell you the number of people who have somehow taken responsibility for the loss, however irrational it was. I probably spent 2 years trying to figure out how I can be blamed for this car accident. And the reason why is because I wanted it to be rational. So, gosh, how rational is it? How easy it is just to say I didn't have enough faith, and that's why my child died. If I would have had more faith, it wouldn't have happened. That's a really easy way to make rational sense out of it. It also makes you miserable, because it's really scary to live in a world that's disordered and does not make rational sense. And that's the world we live in, because it's fallen and it's broken. It doesn't make rational sense. Why is it that the best couples in the world can produce monster children, and some parents who are irresponsible and selfish produce saints? I don't know. Why is it some of the coolest women I know end up marrying rats? I don't know. Why is it that people can write great books that nobody reads, and other people write pathetic books that a lot of people read, and I won't mention any book titles or names right now? Well, what we do when we face that kind of disorder, that irrationality, that fallenness, the brokenness of the world, is simply to figure out, especially if we're firstborn, how we can create order by simply taking responsibility for it ourselves. And one of the easiest ways as Christians just to say, I didn't have enough faith. If I'd had enough, this wouldn't have happened. Which, I mean, think about it. Then I guess we shouldn't have a civil war in southern Sudan if you had enough faith. I mean, take it to its logical conclusion. You know what you're really saying, or whoever's doing that is really saying? I'm not God. And no, you're not. I'm not either. If you're at all a kind of traditional male, one of the first things you do, even if you don't state it directly, it's a kind of unconscious assumption, is that you should be able to protect your family. I failed. So what's the logical conclusion? That if I do my job and I'm a person of faith, I will never have problems again. Everything I do will turn to gold. Every book will be a bestseller. My children will all be saints. Kind of close to it, I suppose, but not quite there. It's just another one of those things we do to try to assert control and to make the world predictable and orderly, and it won't work. Best just to let it go. That makes sense? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, especially now, you know, I met Fitz. Next sermon, please. I will say that now, especially in our evangelical environment in the United States, we're so, as we've lost a sense of the reality of a larger kingdom, so much of our theology and religion is oriented toward this world. And so consequently, we've turned it into a form of self-help, prosperity gospel. If you just learn if you say the right things and you have just the right kind of faith and you memorize the right kind of formula, you are always going to have a good life. And the only thing that results from that theology are a very few successful, powerful people and tons of casualties that end up leaving the church altogether. Yes, Jordy?
But that gets really messy too.
It does.
Be implicating God or saying he made it happen and getting comfort because that creates control, but then we're putting this
terrible
pressure on God that he's done.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's necessarily a better answer. I think we have to ask questions about first principles. What's God up to? Is it just to make the world nice again? Is his goal to recreate the garden in this life? Or is it to redeem a fallen world? And sometimes that's going to turn out well in this world. Life's going to be good again. We're going to fall in love again, or our kids are going to do this, or we're going to be sick and we're going to get well and there's going to be a miracle. John called those signs. And signs are the exception, not the rule. There were only 7 of them in the book of John. And think about this. The raising of Lazarus, wouldn't that have been cool to witness? If you had been Lazarus' sister, Martha and Mary, wouldn't you have been happy when he was resuscitated? Now, what's the dirty little secret about this story? He died again. What's the dirty little secret about the feeding of the 5,000? They all got hungry again. The signs that God gives us in this world are signs of his kingdom work. They're not answers. They're not the thing. They're what point to the thing. His ultimate work is to redeem the world, not to immediately repair it. So we can all embrace the signs that were given along the way. Happy moments, good moments, successes, experiences of beauty and goodness, and miracles. Yes, real miracles. But they're periodic and they're temporary every time. We're all going to die. Every person in this room is going to die, and some of us are going to die tragically. God's ultimate answer is when the kingdom comes permanently and he reestablishes his rule over a broken planet. So yes, God is responsible, but not necessarily as we assign it to him. That's a pathetic attempt to address your question that is worthy of a better theologian than me. Okay, just a couple of concluding comments. One is capacity. I already mentioned that. Capacity for emotion. Capacity to experience and carry the sorrows of others. Capacity for love and goodness. A capacity for appreciation of beauty. I can't help but think my capacity to enjoy my grandchildren is somehow associated with the losses I experienced 27 years ago. Especially my capacity to enjoy watching my kids be parents. That's greater than my enjoyment of my own grandchildren. It's watching my own children. So I think that loss can enable us to grow in our capacity as a violinist using fingertips or as a baker discerning 1% variation in dough. It enlarges, it expands, it deepens. But only over time. So that's one, is development of capacity to carry, to feel, to experience goodness and beauty and so on. A second one is that we can learn to read our own stories in light of the story. So we carry the biblical story so deeply in us that we can't help but read our own stories in light of the various motifs and themes in the biblical story. Is there any surprise? One of my favorite stories in the Bible is the story of Joseph. Makes perfect sense. That's been one of the ways that I've read my own story. There are some stories in literature that have really been helpful to me. I've seen Les Miserables 6 times. There's no wonder why. Another one is a novel I read a few years ago that was like revelatory to me called Island of the World by Michael O'Brien. Has anyone heard of it or read it? Okay, well, there's a good novel you can read. Michael O'Brien, he's an Eastern Orthodox writer. It's a really long novel, and it's a painful one to read. It takes place in the Balkans and ends up in the United States. But the main character of this story becomes a person of such unusual goodness, but it's hard fought. Island of the World. Island of the World. I mean, I read this, and I got done reading this book, and I put it down. Pat was sitting in the living room reading with me. I sat for 2 minutes, and I sobbed so hard, she came over and held me. Because I was so moved by what happened to this man. Goodness was forged in him through suffering. And he became a beautiful person. And I remember saying to Pat, I want to be that man. So you find stories, the biblical story, other secondary stories that carry on themes in the Bible, like from knowledge or from literature and so on, for film. And you integrate these into your life. They make sense out of things. They create a kind of narrative perspective that brings hope and gives you a sense of meaning and vision about what your life can be. I've already mentioned the Psalms. One last one that I've written about before, and that's the difference between fairness and grace. It's inevitable that in loss we're going to say what happened to me was not fair. And my response is to say, do you really want a fair life? I'd rather have grace than fairness. But it means I'm going to take my hits too. But I want to live in a world where there's grace. I do not want what I deserve. I don't want to live in that kind of world. By the way, there's a religion that is that way, then become a Hindu. If you want a complete, you want a world where you get exactly what you deserve, become a Hindu. I would choose to remain Christian because I want grace. I need grace. It means I'm going to have to learn to live in a world with unfairness too. The cross was unfair. Thank God for the cross. Okay. That okay, Jordy? All right, any last comments? No, I want you to go. You just need to go. I want to say I wouldn't have been able to tolerate sitting in those chairs listening to me. So you are all righteous people. And I'm impressed, so thank you. You know what? I'm going to say one last thing. And then I'll pray for you. I really looked hard at the Christian faith after our accident. And to tell you the truth, I found it solid. To me, it made sense out of the world. The doctrine of the fall makes sense out of the world. I mean, it's the one thing that's as plain as the nose on our face. We live in a world that is really broken. And the Bible provides the template, tells us why. Now, I suppose we could then say, well, God, your move here, just make the world perfect again. And he's doing that, just not in the way that we would like. But if he took a shortcut, it would be an insult to us who have been made in his image. If you had a choice between raising a child who could become a good person out of their own free will over time and through suffering, or raise a child that would simply be a perfect child and robotic, which would you choose? You wouldn't choose the latter one. It'd be a lot more convenient. You could go around all your friends and tell them that you had perfect children. You wouldn't have any troubles at all. No, you want the real thing, don't you? You want a child that turns out a way that you hope, but it's going to be hard fought. It's through your hard work and their decision making, and you know that it's full of risk. And that's the world that God created. I want to say hats off to God that he was stupid enough to create that kind of world. Because it's the world that I live in, and it gives me dignity as a human being. I'm a real player here. I can make real choices. I'm not a robot. I can choose against God. And he made the world that way. I can also choose for him. So, man, I've thought about these things and it just kept pulling me back. Pulling me back to that redemptive story. Lord, thank you for that story. And thank you that you chose to enter it. Not with panache. Not with flash, not with big muscle. You came as a servant, and you suffered for us to redeem our lives and to take all of our losses, to gather them all together in your arms, and to say to us that through Christ, his death and resurrection, all in the end will be well. And thank you for that promise. In Christ's name, amen. Bless you all. Wish you well.